The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
What does Colgate mean by live life to the brightest? Could it be a rich glass of red sipped inside a Parisian cafe on a snowy night when my gaze is met by a tall, mysterious... I mean, brushing is directed with Colgate Optic White Pro Series Toothpaste gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 3 days, so you can live life to the brightest and finish that glass without worrying about teeth stains. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The following podcast contains explicit language. The Slate Audiobook Club is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/slateabc.
Welcome to the Slate Audiobook Club's discussion of Bleeding Edge by Thomas Pynchon. I'm Dan Coyce, editor of the Slate Book Review, and I am here in Slate's New York recording studio. Joining us from D.C. is XX co-founder Hanna Rosin. Hello, Hanna.
Hi.
And with me here in New York is our special guest for this podcast, Browbeat's own Forrest Wickman. Hello, Forrest.
Hello.
So we, as always in the audiobook club, we recommend that you listen to us after you read the book, unless you love being spoiled for plot details, in which case, fine, listen. I mean, we want you to listen whenever. It doesn't actually matter to us.
Not that any of us will be able to understand the plot of this book.
Right. And as much as there are plot details that we understand well enough to spoil, we will be maybe incorrectly right. or inaccurately spoiling plot details.
Not that Pynchon cares about the plot, but
right,
we'll
right.
save that for later. Yeah.
Right. So usually in these discussions, I try to start off with like some kind of, you know, interesting thematic question that makes me look smart and allows you guys to pick up the ball and start talking. But it seems like the easiest way to start this one is just getting this out of the way right away. Hanna, you hated this book.
Oh, my God. You're setting me up for like all the Pynchon hate mail straight from the start so they can stop listening and send right. me an email. Fine. Just do it. I really don't even think that this is a novel. I think it's like an idea, and you're forced to live inside this idea. And if you don't actually happen to belong to the church, then you have no idea what's going on, and it's slightly boring. And frankly, like the idea driving the book about technology not being neutral and somehow connected to terror seems like juvenile and uninteresting. I am open to the idea that, you know, technology corrupts us in many, many ways. And I've read lots of novels, and we can talk about them later, which I think do a much more subtle job of it. But that seems to me like an infantile conspiracy theory idea. So that's the first problem, is the idea doesn't interest me. So I'm already starting out on the wrong foot. And then the execution I thought was terrible. Like the writing is bad. There's no like interesting characters in this book. The plot, he's sort of indifferent to it. And the main character, Maxine, seems indifferent to the investigation. I have no idea why she's doing it or why she trips from one place to the other. And I get that that's supposed to be in our face. Like, you know, Pynchon does these coincidences which couldn't possibly happen. And these names we are supposed to understand are not true. But they're not exactly funny. So I'm not really sure what's supposed to turn me on in this book.
Hannah, Forrest and I just like both fell over.
We're on the ground. We're recording from the ground.
Right.
Of Slate's New York Studio.
Why did you set me up? I'm like, you let me go. You let me do the whole rant. You didn't even let me like peel it out so, slowly. Like.
That seemed the most pinch-y way to launch into this.
Yeah,
right. So now we have this entire web of complaints of yours to untangle and unthread and see what we can make out.
Okay.
Including
fine.
The complaint that it is not only a bad book, but it is not, in fact, a book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Which seems like the
which
ultimate
I love.
Conspiracy
and I think it's
theory.
Totally right in a way. I get that.
Right. Yeah. It's like an information download, not necessarily a book.
So one just relevant question maybe. Is this your first Pynchon book?
No,
then, or have you read a bunch? Okay. And do you feel this way about all of them?
You know, it's so funny. I went back and read them and I thought, like, was I just younger and like more open to conspiracy theories? The Crying of Lot 49? Like, was I just more into it? First of all, that book is much shorter. So maybe it did not irritate me. Quite so much. And I think this was the laziest of them, I have to say. Like, I do think this was somewhat lazier than the rest of them. Like, I can tolerate conspiracy theory, but this was just not, you know, it was lazy, it was long. You know, I think one critic wrote this and I felt exactly this way. Like, it could have been 300 pages shorter or 400 pages longer. Like, it just didn't really matter, like, when it began and ended, you know, as she tripped through her various investigation, which she didn't seem to give a shit about.
This was my first Pynchon novel. So I was not a member of the choir. I was not, you know, a previous Pynchon fan or aficionado or obsessive. So I really liked it. I totally enjoyed it. I thought the writing was great.
Oh,
ho, take
God,
that.
It's so bad. Like, can we read some of the writing, by the
way? Yeah, I'm going to read some
please.
Of the
I can't wait.
Some of the fantastic
yes.
writing and listen to you scoff. I loved the riffage of it, and it seemed to me that this was a book that I was just happy to live in over the course of its existence, which, as you say, could have been 300 pages less or 400 pages more, but I didn't really mind. It was, like, sort of functioned for me in the way that, like, Deep Archer functions for the people that are in it. Deep Archer in the book is this, like, immersive computer quote-unquote game, but really just an environment of the sort that novelists always put into novels but don't actually really take off in the real world.
It's sort of like Second Life, I guess.
It's sort of like Second Life.
I like the Deep Archer scenes, although I am no longer your friend, but I did
right.
like the Deep
I understand
Archer
that.
Scenes.
Yeah. But, like, so the book functioned to me the way that Deep Archer functions for the people who use it. It was a place to go into and explore and be, like, constantly wowed by levels of fine-grained detail and programming that I'd never seen before, and then to step out and, like, basically forget about it. Like, this book, a month from now, I will not remember a single plot detail of this book. I barely remember them now. But I will definitely remember, like, the sort of creepy, funny, interesting feeling of being inside it, which I totally enjoyed the whole time. And I was never bored. Like, you're telling me that you were bored going through this book is fascinating to me because, like, the one thing I was, thanks to the energy of the sentences and the energy of the descriptions, was I was never, ever, ever bored.
Yeah, but you got to be a little ADD not to be bored by this book because there's nothing pulling you through, right? There's
Did
nothing...
you just diagnose me?
No, it's just like, so you read, this is sort of the first 10 pages don't really have anything to do with the next 10 pages. She's just sort of like stumbling through this investigation and, you know, meeting people. Sometimes she's in the offices of Hash Slinger, you know, then she's going to her Krav Maga person. Like, they're just not really connected. There's no like narrative thread. You know, even September 11th, and maybe this is intentional, is kind of anticlimactic. It's not like the book, you know, the way we've had a lot of September 11th books that like build up to that moment and
right.
then all kinds of stuff happens and then there's, you know, the aftermath. It's not even really like that. Like, you don't even remember when September 11th happened in this book.
So A, thank God for that, that it's not like a big build up to September 11th. But then B, I feel like the structure of the book is essentially a parody of or a riff on the sort of classic Private Dick story where things happen and trails get followed and people come back and provide information. But in this one, you're right that many of the things just lead off into weirder and weirder, like, fractal paths.
Yeah, but, like, I was wishing I was reading Jim Thompson. It's funny you should say that because, you know, there are, you know, these hard-boiled detective writers who know how to, for example, use brand names and or who know how to write in a way which is incredibly clipped, you know, or who know how to make these characters sort of, even if they're stock types, like, incredibly interesting and tragic in their way. Like, what do you think of Maxine? Like, who is she?
I liked her.
I think I largely agree with Dan, although I feel like if I read a few more Pynchon books, I may start to agree with you, Hannah, because it's true, I didn't care about the plot and the mystery in this book because at this point I've learned that it is just a Shaggy Dog story and it's not really going to go anywhere, but I also just enjoy all of the sort of wackiness along the way. It's funny, you were miserable reading this book. This was probably the most pleasurable reading experience I had this year, at least reading a novel. I think it's hilarious. I think that I laughed, you know, there's a joke a page. I didn't laugh at all of them. Because the one time I was bored is it is easy to get totally disoriented, as you're supposed to be with these books. And in those cases, I would sometimes get bored or just frustrated, more accurately. So, you know, as a sort of small book, as a lark, as a Shaggy Dog story, I found it really entertaining. As a big book about 9/11 and the internet and New York City and the 90s, I have mixed feelings about it. So I'm sort of interested to go through those different topics and how the book treats them.
Well, so let's start with Maxine, Hannah, as you suggested. So I did really like Maxine. I thought she was a compelling and smart character with just a lot going on. Like, I liked her relationship with Horst and how that developed and deepened along the way, much to her surprise. I liked her sort of complicated lust.
How did that develop more than, like, you know, Veep and her ex-husband? Like, it's just he would come in and out and they'd have sex sometimes. Or, like, what? How did it develop?
Well, because at the beginning of the novel, they're functionally separated and divorced, and she finds him mostly exasperating. By the end of the novel, she has come to value him in a real way, to value the things that he brings to her life and the balance that he offers in the midst of this, like, total insanity. And part of it is those couple of hours where she wasn't sure what happened to him after 9/11. But yeah, part of it is also just that he is, like, sort of a stolid thing in her life that she finds she can count on in the midst of all this other bullshit that's happening to her. Like, I liked that. But I also liked that she had this, like, inexplicable, awful, horrific lust for Windust,
right,
the trained killer working for some secret government agency. And I liked her feelings towards her kids, and I liked how good she was at her job, even though, as you say, she wasn't driven into this investigation by passion or anything. She did care about it, and she cared about the guy who got killed in the building across the street, and she cared about why people were messing with her, and she cared about being right. And I like a character like that who knows things and who is not shy about making it clear to the world that she knows them and is smart and funny about it.
You know, that was pretty convincing. I realized as both of you were talking that one of my problems is this intentional disorientation infuriated me. Like,
right,
even though I understand that I was supposed to be living in Deep Archer and getting lost in corners and sort of not quite following a unified linear plot, I got irritated with that. So I would lose the thread of Maxine and I would forget what Horst was like or what Reg was like. I would just kind of forget who they were because
right,
they were each put out in sort of small snippets. But as you now did for me, a coherent character description of Maxine, I already like this book 15% better. So maybe by the end, I would love it. I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know. But it is true that if there are many readers who, if this is the kind of book that sounds on their face like it would annoy them, it will definitely annoy
them.
Right.
Yeah.
There's like, if you think you're going to hate this book, you will definitely hate this book.
In fact, yeah, I was impressed by your defense, Dan, and that was way more than I ever could have said about Maxine. I should say I read the book like 2 months ago and I've tried to refresh myself. So there's more than one reason that I don't remember the plot that well. But I mostly just don't worry about motivation and it making sense altogether. Like, I think if you come to a book like this and you sort of judge it against the typical rules of a novel, it's just going to be perpetually frustrating. And so there are characters there and they sometimes make sense and then often they don't. I mean, sometimes little people show up out of nowhere, like from behind the radiator, and it's just like, oh, okay, was kind of funny.
The guy from Cosmo.com shows up to drop
right,
off the next
right,
clue.
So the guy from Cosmo.com is like basically a joke on plot contrivance, I think,
right?
Right? It's just like Pynchon, whenever he wants to, he doesn't know how to move the plot forward, he sends over Marvin from Cosmo, and he's like, here's the next plot development.
Right.
And I found that sort of funny.
Yeah, but he knows he's doing, like, the names, you know, Conkling, Speedwell. I made myself a list of all the insane Chaz Larden, Vip Epperdew.
Yeah. I mean, what? The protagonist of Lot 49 is like Oedipa Moss.
Right.
So this is nothing new.
Let's take a quick break to pause for a word from our sponsor, audible.com, and then we will continue this extremely fun argument. So Audible.com is the leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the internet. Everywhere on the deep web that you want to find audio content, you can find it at Audible.com. You can choose from more than 100,000 audiobooks and listen to them on nearly any device, including the one you're using to listen to us right now. Audible has a special offer for Audiobook Club listeners. When you sign up for a 30-day free trial membership, you will get one, count them, one free audiobook of your choice. Just visit our special URL, audiblepodcast.com/slateabc. So what will that free book be? Here at the Audiobook Club, we like to recommend next month's discussion book, which I will now reveal to be The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt. Audible has it. It's narrated by David Pichu. And if you sign up using our special URL, you can get all 32 hours and 30 minutes of The Goldfinch narrated to you for free.
Now, there's a damn novel, by the way.
That's not that. Oh, so you're reading. Well, save it for next month, man.
Yeah.
Your membership also includes a free subscription to either the New York Times or Wall Street Journal Daily Audio Digest. So give it a try. And please use our URL so Audible knows that you are an Audiobook Club listener. audiblepodcast.com/slateabc. All right, so.
All right, let me go. Because now that I'm sidling up to what Pynchon is trying to do, I want to put this out there. So maybe like Maxine's indifference and the sort of general lack of very passionate motivation is supposed to mimic our relationship with the interwebs. Like, our just kind of casual acceptance of this thing that's come to take over our lives when at the heart of it is like a horrible conspiracy. But we are not realizing it because we're sort of traipsing from place to place and, oh, look, another website. Like, we are basically living the way Maxine lives this investigation.
I'll say sure with the caveat that you could have literally said anything about this book and ended it, comma, man. And I would have been like, yes, sure. That sounds great. Like, I did not necessarily draw, for example, like an anti-technology message out of this book. There are a lot of things about technology that Thomas Pynchon really seems to enjoy.
Yeah. I dug this up. I didn't even know it existed before. But he wrote this essay in 1984 at the dawn of what he called the computer age, capital C, capital A. And so it was in defense of Luddites. I forget what the headline was exactly. But it was also sort of a complication of the whole idea where he talked about how, you know, the original Luddites, or, you know, the guy Ludd was his name, you know, didn't hate, I think it was the sewing machine, but he hated how, you know, it took away jobs from all of these people who previously had them. It was sort of more of a Marxist thing. And so I think that's how he felt about technology in 1984. And I don't know, I think that makes sense for me in terms of how he thinks about it now, which is sometimes it can be great and really amazing. And he seems to, you know, have some fondness for the internet, but he also doesn't trust all of it. And he hates how it's like sort of gentrified. That is one place where I didn't relate to him at all, because this book, in a way that's similar to some of his previous books, it seems to capture like this frontier before it's colonized and made really safe and boring, kind of like New York itself is in this book. And I don't know. I don't think the internet is safe and boring and gentrified now. It's still crazy and full of wacko conspiracy theorists like Thomas Pynchon.
You know, I'm looking for that speech by her father. You know?
Oh, I love it.
Oh, yeah.
Can you read that speech? I can't find it right now. Hold on.
I've got it right here. It's 422-ish.
Yeah, 422, and that's not even the end of the book.
Right. Okay, so...
Oh, here it is. Yes.
Are you talking about the one about...
The CIA, how it was conceived in sin. No, I'm talking about the speech where he talks about the internet being conceived in sin.
We should say, this speech is also from what? From Maxine's dad, who is kind of an old guy.
Right. Yeah, but I'm taking him as a stand-in for
Pynchon. Which Pynchon is, too. I don't know if... I think he might just be an old crank.
So I'm going to read two paragraphs from this section, which is a conversation between Maxine and her dad. The section you're talking about is on 420, Hannah, and it goes... He's talking about the terror of, like, the Rand Corporation and everyone who created the internet in the Eisenhower years and afterwards. And he goes, yep, and your internet was their invention, this magical convenience that creeps now like a smell through the smallest details of our lives, the shopping, the housework, the homework, the taxes, absorbing our energy, eating up our precious time. And there's no innocence anywhere. Never was. It was conceived in sin, the worst possible. As it kept growing, it never stopped carrying in its heart a bitter, cold death wish for the planet. And don't think anything has changed, kid. So do you really think that that's how Thomas Pynchon feels about technology and the internet?
The language is so heightened.
Heightened. That's a nice way to put it.
It's like he could not possibly be overstating it any more than to say,
right.
You know, carrying in his heart a bitter cold death wish for the planet.
Like,
there's no way. I mean, he's way too smart. If he hated the internet that much, he wouldn't phrase it that
and
way.
And he also wouldn't, like, show so much affection for the crazy people who make the internet in this book. Even like, the stupid, corrupt ones are still, like, super interesting to him in a way that's just he could not hate technology as much as you think he does.
So what about those weird Arabs in the bathroom? What's up with that? Like, that hash lingers. Like, when you finally come down to the heart of the sin, it involves Arabs in the bathroom speaking Arabic.
I don't think there is a heart of the sin in this book.
I don't think, I mean, we never get to the heart of anything in this book, I think. As you guys said, it's like departure. We never, it's too vast and too ever-changing for us to ever get to the root of anything.
Right,
and that's
and
how
I guess
it always is.
So he's just teasing the conspiracy theorists. He's just like teasing them to bring them
I think that's
to his team.
But
you can be a conspiracy theorist and believe that you and Pynchon are on the same side, like be one of these deep net people who, you know, erases all your cookies and like is paranoid that the government is after you. And like you think Pynchon is your, you know, spokesman, but he's not.
Now, I don't get the impression that he subscribes to any of these conspiracy theories. I think that he just enjoys conspiracy theories and like the concept of making them, you know, and the way they spread and the way they move around, you know. I was thinking about this, like, it's not like he's a 9/11 truther or something. I sort of think of him as, like, he's more like a falser. Like, he's interested in tracking all the 1 million different crazy theories that scattered around 9/11 and everything having to do with it. That's interesting to him. But I don't think that he would ally himself with any of them.
Nor do I think he necessarily believes that they're all false. I mean, I agree with you. I think he's mostly interested in them for their wackiness, and I think he probably doesn't believe them, but I don't know if he would necessarily rule them out either. He almost never rules anything out.
In my head, I was comparing him to the new Dave Eggers book, you know, The Circle. Now, The Circle, I was thinking of Pynchon as like to the right in terms of like who's the most conspiratorial, like who sees technology as more evil. But maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe the difference between those two, Eggers clearly has an idea, right? That book is sort of the Orwellian creep of technology. Maybe this book just like is more playful, like it plays with the idea, but it doesn't land hard on it the way The Circle does.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. Like all these theories are spouted, but they're spouted beside other theories about little people behind their radiators and people hallucinating like dead people and electrical outlets. And I mean, the very fact that like at the end of the book, the departure is like maybe the afterlife, or maybe there are dead people down there, but we don't really know whether they're dead people or just, you know, avatars pretending to be victims of 9/11. So I think it's all viewed as possibly right, but
and that's where the like not, the Beanie Baby obsession, like he gives you little comic interludes, like what's her name with the Z, what's her name who's obsessed with the Beanie Babies,
Verva. So I want to read another section from that same scene between Maxine and her dad, which was a moment at which I really deeply loved this book because, you know, having never read Pynchon before, I thought of him in my head as, you know, I knew that he loved conspiracy theories and that he was brainy and funny and weird, but I had not really thought of him as like someone who was good at writing moving scenes that might move me in some way, but this scene really did. She is complaining or sort of feeling bad about the fact that she has this weird relationship with Windust, and she thinks that he is redeemable, even though he's almost certainly not redeemable. And her dad says,
"Where are you?"
I'm at the bottom of 421 going into 422. Mm-hmm. He goes, "You were always like this. I kept waiting for you to give it up, let it go, turn as cold as the rest of us, praying all the time you wouldn't. You'd come back from school, history classes, some new nightmare, the Indians, the Holocaust, crimes I hardened my heart against years ago, taught them but didn't feel them so much anymore, and you'd be so angry, passionately hurting, your little hands and fists. How could anybody do these things? How could they live with themselves? What was I supposed to say? We handed you the tissues and said, 'It's grown-ups. Some act that way. You don't have to be like them. You can be better. Best we could ever come up with. Pathetic. But you know what? I never found out what we should have said. Think I'm happy about that?' And then she talks about how her boys ask the same things, and the scene ends in a very sweet way. But like that passage crushed me. Oh, I mean, I related to it.
You know why that passage crushed you? Because you have waited 422 pages for an emotional passage. That's why it crushed you.
There are others. There are others.
Oh, my God. There's so few and far between. There's so few and far between.
Sure. But when they hit, boy, do they hit.
Because you're like starving there. You're like,
okay. Also because they're good, Hannah.
That's not that good. It's like, okay. It's fine. I mean, it's fine. It's all right.
So let's talk about the jokes. I really loved the laugh lines in this book. There's that bit where Maxine talks about how she loves the Knicks because she's fascinated by Latrell Sprewell because Homer strangling Bart is not interesting, but when Bart strangles Homer, that's interesting.
That was good.
Or like the fact that there's an entire plot device revolving around the horrible stench of the old 930 Club in Washington, D.C., or that incredible description of IKEA when there's just like a paragraph where she's talking about how one time they went to IKEA and Pynchon describes IKEA so amazingly as this like fractal, hellish netherworld that where they direct you to the exit, but you never actually reach it. That made me like wish that he just like wrote the occasional like Times Magazine feature about something. Like I would totally read that. But this book definitely like made me laugh a lot, like literally laugh out loud many times. Like,
or the fact that there's a strip club called Joie de Vivre.
Joie de Vivre. And or when someone goes, well, you know what Susan Sontag says, and Maxine goes, I like the streak, I think I'll keep it.
Wait, can we just point out that Hannah has been laughing hysterically?
Okay, those are
end?
Good.
I
you're
thought
right,
you said it
right.
wasn't funny.
No, no, you're right.
Maybe
you're right.
I was flipping through the book today, and I found that I highlighted this passage, and it is of no significance whatsoever. I think the best passages in this book are both funny and touching, and I could give example of that. But what I found instead was his tale of the, you know, it's like a 1993 movie or something called Scooby Goes Latin. I don't know if you guys remember this, but it's a tale in which like Scooby is down in Colombia and he teams up with all of these Colombian kids and they're trying to take down this drug cartel guy who's in Medellin, who is pretending to be a ghost. And then it's all just a setup for this line at the end where he says, and I would have got away with it too if it hadn't been for those Medellin kids. And come on, like, it's you know, puns are not the highest form of humor, but like he is
the highest form of punter.
He is the most high wire punter right. I've ever encountered.
I liked all the movies in this, all the biopics that Horst
is always
watching. The golf
biopics I didn't totally get, I have to say.
Oh, I just love the idea that there were these, that there's a whole cottage industry of biopics in this alternate universe, like the Anton Chekhov story starring right. Edward Norton with Peter Sarsgaard as Stanislavski. That's great. So it seems to me, Hannah, that one of the issues are that you did find things that you liked in this book, but you were so overwhelmed with annoyance at its sort of essential guiding principle of aimlessness that you couldn't enjoy those things the way you might have otherwise in a different book.
Yeah, because everything you guys said is really funny. I mean, right. Those are really good. And I might have given up on it too early. Like, I might have skipped over. Like, I got so sort of irritated because I couldn't follow what was going on.
Right.
Like, then you miss a lot. Right? That's right. Like an anal way to approach this book because if you're not going to let yourself just kind of wander a little bit, and maybe I would have been more patient to wander if there weren't 500 pages to wander through, but if you're not going to let yourself wander, like, you know, you're going to miss the charms of the book.
I wouldn't describe that as a failing necessarily. That is just, this was not the book for you at this point in time.
Yeah, like the normal writing, like I'm just now remembering his initial description of Reg. Is his name Reg Despard? Mm-hmm. Have you ever met anyone with any single name of anyone in this book except Maxine?
Maybe no. Sean, her analyst.
Sean.
Yeah. I love Sean.
Yeah.
Couple years, in fact, Reg Despard looked considerably hammered at by the interval. I don't even know, like that grammar is really weird. He's a documentary guy who began as a movie pirate back in the 90s, going into matinees with a borrowed camcorder to tape first-run features off the screen, from which he then duped cassettes that he sold on the street for $1, $2 sometimes if he thought he could get it, often turning a profit before the movie was through before its opening weekend.
And then he becomes like a legit documentary filmmaker who people hire because someone loved his
funny.
Aesthetic in the way he framed a screen as he was pirating a movie.
Maybe this is like a girl-boy thing. Like, he describes people and explains people by the things they do. Right? Like, there's nothing internal in this book at all. Like, even the descriptions of Maxine are descriptions through conversation or dialogue or through something she does as she's speaking to her kids. Like, nothing is internal. It's all
external.
Well,
that's very hard-boiled, though. I mean, that is, I've never read a hard-boiled mystery where someone is like, then he felt sad.
Right.
Like, that's not the point of a hard-boiled mystery.
Right. Right.
Does it throw you maybe that the main character, the hard-boiled PI, is a woman with kids who in a different book would be described in very specifically like emotional or traditionally female terms? I mean, do you think that
that might be the problem? Because I was reading Goldfinch kind of simultaneously, and it is, you know, precisely the opposite of this book. Like, it begins with the most like wrenching internal description you can possibly imagine, right? And there's also sort of a mother in it and a child, and it's like it's just so radically different in its approach to humanity than this book that, you know, maybe that did me wrong.
I do want to talk briefly about Thomas Pynchon, 76-year-old dude who somehow just knows more about modern day New York than I do, or maybe than any of us do. Like, I mean, I guess it's not modern day, it's 2001 New York, but there was not a single pop culture reference, whether real or imagined, in this book where I was like, oh, that's an old man talking. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He just, like, knows shit. I don't know if he has, like, a great research staff or is he just really paying a lot of attention. But, like, this passage on page 302, which is a description of a 1999-themed party that they have here in 2001, where they were already feeling nostalgia for the pre-bubble era. But so it's all these things that are going on in this party. The Soviet-era sound system, looted from a failed arena somewhere in Eastern Europe, is also blasting Blink-182, Echo and the Bunnymen, Bare Naked Ladies, Bone Thugs and Harmony, and other sentimental oldies, while vintage stock quotations from the boom year's NASDAQ crawl along a ticker display on a frieze running the full perimeter of the ballroom. Beneath giant 4x6-meter LED screens onto which bloom and fade loops of historical highlights, like Bill Clinton's grand jury testimony, the other Bill, Gates, getting a pie in the face in Belgium, the announcement trailer for Halo, clips from the Dilbert animated TV series, the first season of SpongeBob, Roman Coppola's Boo.com commercials, Monica Lewinsky hosting Saturday Night Live, Susan Lucci finally winning a daytime Emmy for Erica Kane. Like, these are right. And these are not things that you could necessarily Google now as you're writing this book. So, like, he was paying attention in 1999, and he is paying attention now in ways that are just amazing to me. And so,
and you don't find that to be just like an insane overload of pop culture and period detail?
Of course it's an insane overload of
pop
culture.
Yeah, but it just gives me a headache. Like, ugh, yeah.
But I think actually that's a really key scene, because this book is full of nostalgia for this pre-9/11 time of the late 90s. But you also, within that nostalgia that we might feel, you also get this depiction of, you know, the dot-com nostalgia for their, like, pre-bubble time, which appears totally ridiculous to us. And so I don't think that Pynchon always answers perfectly well every criticism that can be lobbed against him, but he's clearly aware of them and can acknowledge them in very funny ways, like this scene.
And I'm interested as well in why he chose this time. Like, there are two very specifically relevant things about choosing the year 2001 to set your New York novel. And one of them, obviously, is 9/11. And we've talked about that a little, that it, for me, it serves as like a locus of a million conspiracy theories. And so it's a useful hinge to sort of have this novel turn around. But then the other is the dot-com collapse, which it seems to me, as someone who moved to New York just shortly after the events of this book, like, I remember the dot-com collapse very clearly. Like, it seems very well turned to me, like this sense of this amazing thing built on air that then somehow collapsed. And I have very vivid memories of me and my friends in print media and the schadenfreude we felt about all our friends from college who'd become millionaires, but then they lost their millions. I mean, it was very short-lived because it turned out they all became millionaires again. But, like, this entire world is just very convincingly turned out to me. Though I don't think this is like a definitive chronicle of this era, I do think it's an extremely fascinating and vivid portrait of an era that I would never have imagined Thomas Pynchon to have been paying attention to at all.
Well, he is pretty good on people facing space, like in Deep Archer. Like, I do like the scenes when Maxine walks into empty offices. Like, there's not really a lot of mood in this book, but he does, you know, he puts the person in the place where there's one person sitting in the office and they're dismantling the office, and you kind of get what he's trying to say.
And again, he is paying attention. He sees what that looks like, and he's giving you what that looks like and by extension feels like.
So can we talk a little bit about what Deep Archer means? Like, what is the significance? What is Deep Archer a metaphor for?
I think it is a metaphor for nearly everything. What do you think, Forrest?
I think that's exactly right.
It's so easy to answer questions about this book, because the answer is always whatever.
Everything. Whatever.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, so all of Pynchon's books have this great unknown that you know, all these connections that the characters are sort of struggling to put together and some secret that may or may not be at the bottom of everything. I was looking at this passage from Triangle Plot 49 that sums it up. Basically, it says that Oedipa is looking for, quote, another mode of meaning behind the obvious or none. And I think that that is something that's in every book, but this book is in some ways more accessible because it's this very literal, if not physical, thing that just represents all the great mysteries that may or may not really be there and have great truth in them.
Right. So it might just be like she's sucked into a video game the way other people play like Angry Birds or
right.
whatever. And,
right.
And I have think, no yeah. meaning at all.
Right. It's the deep web. It's also Departure, which is, you know, like a pun on escapism, I think, which is a whole other aspect of it.
Do you guys think Thomas Pynchon likes living in New York?
Yes. He couldn't live anywhere else. Like, he's just a creature of New York. He
but
probably
didn't he
likes
live
or,
like, until, like, the last couple decades or something.
I feel like the rumor about him was always that he, like, lived in Southern California or Mexico,
Mexico
or something.
Mexico for a while. Yeah.
And then he married his literary agent and, I think, moved to New York. But was he always a creature of New York? I mean, he was born in Long Island.
Yeah. I mean, so we sort of questioned that on the fact that he's lived other places. But I also totally agree with you because his sort of sensibility is so New York. And I think he has a total love-hate relationship with it, the way that most New Yorkers have
yeah.
a love-hate relationship with
New
York and with everything.
I loved that video game that her kids are playing where you just get to like cleanly execute the annoying people of New York, like
right.
the woman at Fairway
right.
who's eating the grapes.
Yeah.
Like, could you imagine if someone actually made that game? It would be unbelievably popular, but only in New York.
And their defense of it was pretty great. Like, their defense of why it wasn't actually violent.
Yeah.
Because they turned off the blood splatter.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Can we read the Thanksgiving scene, which was one of my favorite scenes in the book? And also,
yeah.
I guess you guys, it was interesting to me that 9/11 brushed by like nothing for you guys. Well, for a long time, I was wondering whether 9/11 was going to happen at all, because this book exists in this weird place that's totally historical. And also, there are weird things that never actually existed in it.
Right. Like the Anton Chekhov story.
Yeah.
Starring Peter
Sarsgaard. Which, I mean, there's tons of really heavy foreshadowing in the book, but it also, that did put a little bit of suspense back in it for mm-hmm. me and made me sort of wish that it wasn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I had, like, nightmares reading, just, like, a couple nights when I was getting towards the end of the book.
You wow.
guys, so you guys didn't have, like, any emotional connection to the... I'm not surprised because I don't...
To the 9/11 part specifically?
Yeah,
I
yeah.
mean, I was worried about... I was actually pretty worried about Horst.
Right,
But
yeah.
no, like, it was dealt with in a way that to me was like the right way to deal with it in a book, which is like, we all know this thing happened and it totally sucked. Let's like get past it as quickly as we can. And then mm-hmm. his description of the aftermath in New York was like very right on, like the way that sort of like the connection to the tragedy changed as you migrated north of 14th Street
mm-hmm.
and the way the police were like, despite everything, you wanted to like love the police because of what they suffered, but they were like extra super assholes in the months following 9/11. And like that all seemed right on to me, but the actual event was not like emotionally crushing to me.
Yeah.
But sorry, read the thing.
No, I agree that all of that was very vivid and was something I wasn't really familiar with as somebody who did mostly experience it through the media. But anyways, the parts about New York after 9/11 were my favorite and were the parts that he seemed to have the most connection to. And so there's this part where it's Thanksgiving and they're all going to get a turkey.
What page are you on?
In line. It's on page 381.
Oh, the line. Oh, yes, the line.
Right.
Oh, yes.
So I think, you know, it's the morning of and they've put it off, of course. And then, so this guy is, he's trying to cut ahead in the line, which is not allowed. He says, I have a house of children to feed. But he's interrupted by a voice someplace over by the loading dock hollering, hey, asshole! And here, cannonballing over the heads of the crowd, comes a frozen turkey, hits the bothersome yup square in the head, knocking him flat and bouncing off his head into the hands of Maxine, who stands blinking at it like Betty Davis at some baby with whom she must unexpectedly share the frown. She hands the object to the lady behind her. This is yours, I guess. What, after it touched him? Thanks anyway. I'll take it, says the guy behind her. As the line creeps forward, everybody makes sure to step on, not over, the fallen line jumper. Nice to see the old town getting back to normal, ain't it? And that was just a great scene of New Yorkers coming
like
together by hating each other.
10 different
is,
delightful things in that.
Yeah,
passage.
So many different things.
Yeah, but yeah. it's like a cartoon. Right?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there are references to like Looney Tunes in these books, and I think that's an influence.
Yes, this
for,
is a Looney Tunes cartoon moment. Right.
It's a Looney Tunes book in many ways. So did we at least help you to contextualize your hate?
Yeah,
on,
you really
this book?
Did. And I'm trying to think like if I like, how could I get over? Because there's clearly gems in here. So how could one get over oneself? Like, you're going to ask me if I would recommend this book.
Yeah.
And I can't quite recommend this book. On the other hand, you guys are right. There are so many gems in here that you just have to get over yourself.
A great way to experience this book is to listen to a podcast where people just tell you a lot of
Well, you know, I just had another idea. Like, why? What if you turned it into like a bathroom book so you could read it a few pages at a time without, you know, forcing yourself to experience it as a full novel?
That's a great idea.
And so you would come across like you would come across like gems. You know, you would read it like 10 pages at a time and you would laugh out loud, but you would read it in this disconnected way and that would be okay.
Like when a character shows up again 150 pages later, when you're reading as a novel, you get sidetracked by being like, oh God,
who was that? And then I go back.
Who was it? Why does he matter? But in fact, it doesn't matter.
Right.
And if you read it as a bathroom book, it allows you to let go of the belief that maybe it does matter. You can just be like, oh, here's this character.
Right.
Let's see what he does.
Okay.
So you recommend it as a bathroom book.
Yes, like, I recommend it as
Uncle Tom Pynchon's bathroom reader.
Exactly.
I love it.
Okay.
Forrest, recommend?
I mean, I totally recommend it as a bathroom book. I think, I mean, so no. But this is what I'm saying. That like half of me is just like, oh, I enjoy Thomas Pynchon like I enjoy Tom Robbins, or at least did back in high school and college. And so there's always that, which will make me enjoy reading him. But I think, you know, that's not the only thing he's trying to do. And so I also thought it was sort of half successful as a treatment of the internet, and maybe only a third successful as a treatment of 9/11, and, you know, very successful as a treatment of New York.
I really liked it a lot, and I would totally recommend it. I also think it's entirely possible that if I read more Thomas Pynchon books, I would, like, reach a state of diminishing returns as I got more familiar with his techniques and as he moved further away from my own experience. Like, I could totally see them becoming less and less interesting to me.
Oh, that's another thing I wanted to say is, although I have not yet tested this out totally, is that I think this is actually, Hannah, you might disagree, but a great Thomas Pynchon book to start with, because of course it's full of esoterica, but the esoterica is from the 1990s and it's about the internet and stuff, whereas, you know, with Gravity's Rainbow, it's about rocket science, which is something no one understands.
Right.
So there were references to world, you know, 1940s pop culture.
Right.
And so it was easier for me to connect with.
And like the references are sort of possible for a wide range of ages in this book. People of many ages could sort of grasp what he's talking about, you know?
Right. And I agree with you, Forrest. I think that this is a great book for people to figure out whether they would ever like a Thomas Pynchon book.
And if you love this book, then go read Gravity's Rainbow.
Right. Not in the bathroom.
Or don't.
Right.
Or just be happy with this.
Yeah.
All right, thank you guys for this discussion. Hannah, thank you for leading us off with your hate. That really helped. So a program note, in our next audiobook club, we are discussing The Gold Finch, Donna Tartt's big blockbuster about an orphan teenager in New York and his lifelong connection to a mysterious painting. We've got a great conversation between Donna Tartt and her editor at the Slate Book Review. Please check that out. Read or listen to the book and then join us on December 6th for the next audiobook club. The homepage for the Slate Book Review is slate.com/books. You'll find the show pages for this and every episode of the audiobook club at slate.com/ABC. Visit our Facebook page where you can leave a comment on this episode. That address is facebook.com/slateABC. And please subscribe to the podcast in iTunes because that helps other people discover the show. If you search for Slate Audio Book Club in the iTunes store, you'll find it, and don't forget to leave a comment while you're there. Our producer is Abdul Rufus. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Andy Bowers. For Hannah Rosen and Forrest Wickman, I'm Dan Coyce. Thanks for listening.